The Bible study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Good morning. This is Hour 2 of the Bible Study. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thank you for joining us this morning. Now, if you're joining us maybe for the first or second time, you're not quite sure how Ask the Pastor works, pretty simple format. Anything goes. We were talking about the first part of chapter 14 of Hebrews. If you didn't get in during the first hour of the Bible study, second hour is a great time to call in. Also, if there's something in the news, something theological that you've been wondering about, one of those questions, like one that will come up later this morning, what is the difference between a theologian of the cross and a theologian of glory? This is the program and the opportunity for you to call in and ask those questions. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or KFUO at KFUO.org. Now, as you know, there are some pastors who endear themselves to very special theme music, and especially today on this day that the church remembers St. John Chrysostom, Archbishop of Constantinople. It used to be Constantinople, now Istanbul. We welcome back to KFUO our very good friend, Pastor Martin Nolan from Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Pastor, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you all?
Haven't heard that music for a while. It sounds good.
That's good.
And really, today, this is very appropriate. Like I said, it's the day, at least in some parts of the Western Church, that St. John Chrysostom is commemorated, that great archbishop, one of the early church fathers of Constantinople.
That's right.
So why is this man important to the church?
Well, it's interesting how you evaluate people that are important to the church. There are some people that are very well known in their own lifetime, but don't have much effect after that. So they may show up as a bleep on in the book of church history, but they really don't have much effect after that. Chrysostom is unusual in that he has both a great effect in his lifetime and afterward. In his lifetime, as you mentioned, he was the Archbishop of Constantinople, or the Patriarch, actually, would be the term in his day. And he was heavily involved in the growth of the church in the East at the time. He was heavily involved in political government. At the time, Constantinople was the head of the Roman Empire, so he was right in the thick of things. It would be just as if, we had a senior pastor in Congress and the White House, and he was conferring with the upper echelons of government and having influence on what was going on there. So Chrysostom was that sort of influential figure. And then also a lot of his writings, especially his homilies or sermons on the books of the New Testament, were recorded and passed on to future generations throughout the church, by which he became known as one of the doctors of the church. And those are still available today in English in the Nicene Post-Nicene Father series, which many pastors and congregations have. So he still continues to exert influence today, and all of it useful and beneficial to the church.
So what does Chrysostom mean, or is it just a last name?
That is a nickname. As far as I know, it's his nickname. It means a golden mouth or golden tongue. He was originally a hermit. I think of hermit, I think either of Herman's Hermit, which of course dates me, or Hermit Crab, and both of those are wrong. It's more like a guy that lives in a cave, and he did. When he went into the ministry or became religious, he lived in a cave for a while as a hermit monk. and that affected his health so badly. You know, maybe they had that, what is it, that fungus that's killing all the bats? Maybe they had it in the cave, and it was serious, though. And so they said, oh, you can't do this anymore. We don't want you dying. So they put him under a bishop, Flavian of Antioch, and he served there as a deacon and a pastor for 12 years, and he preached there in Antioch, which, of course, we know from the New Testament was a center of Christianity. St. Paul was sent out of there as a missionary. It was really, even in the New Testament years, Antioch was second only to Jerusalem. So anyway, he preached there in Antioch for 12 years, and during that time, his skills as an orator or preacher became well known throughout the Christian church, and that's how he got the name of Golden Mouth or Golden Tongue.
Well, he was a bit of a troublemaker, though, wasn't he?
Well, that was after he was, as far as I know, he really didn't get into trouble in his earlier years, and it was when he became Patriarch of Constantinople, which is that theme song goes back to my head every time I say that.
That's right. That's why we do it.
And he tried to be a reformer. You know what I've said before about a reformer, you want to have a prince on your back.
Yes.
Or watching your back. Well,
it pays to have a good prince, yeah.
That's what it is. It pays to have a good prince to watch your back. Well, in this case, some of the comments that John made were directed against the empress, Eudoxia. I believe that's how you say her name. And she didn't take kindly to that. Well, after all, she was the queen. You know, you think about, I don't know if you've seen the new Alice in Wonderland movie that stars Johnny Depp. My kids love watching that. They have this, my kids have the same sort of warped sense of reality and humor that I do, so they just love that movie. But anyway, there's a great figure there in that Alice in Wonderland movie. I believe it's the Queen of Hearts. And, you know, if you cross her just a little bit or just look at her the strange way, it's off with your head. And that's what queens were known for. This Eudoxia, maybe she didn't do that to her subjects, but she was very vain. She was not, unlike with Elizabeth of Hungary, she was not really interested in taking care of the poor. And her dress was very luxurious, gold beads and everything else. And it just put everybody else to shame. The problem is, she was supposed to be a Christian and sort of a model Christian. I think, for example, of the... I recently read a Time article about Queen Elizabeth II. And the Time magazine article said that the queen was well-trained in her early years, and she has been a model queen in her behavior and deportment and everything else. And they suggested that the, what's her name, the new bride, wife of Prince William, whatever her name is, but she should follow the example of Queen Elizabeth II. Well, this is really what privately the John was saying to Eudoxia. You know, you need to set a good example in every way because we are a Christian nation. The Roman Empire is a Christian nation. Well, Eudoxia had different ideas, and so there was soon a falling out between the two, and she tried to get rid of him, at least to make him to come down in position so he wasn't the patriarch. And at the, 403 A.D., 36 bishops at the Synod of the Oak condemned him on 29 charges and ordered that he should be deposed and exiled. And this got to be so big because he was very popular among the Christians. And everybody was a Christian, but, you know, you had different ideas of what it means to be a Christian.
Sure.
That civil war started out or was threatened because they were going to depose the patriarch. Can you imagine that? Civil war. And then an earthquake shook the city in the midst of this. And that scared everybody. So Eudoxia revoked the banishment order. That tells you that she really was pulling the strings there. And then, well, he couldn't be quiet about things. And within the next year, during the public games, which would be like our Olympic games, they erected a silver statue of Eudoxia in her memory while she was still alive. And, of course, she really loved this, and he said this was improper, not good for a Christian according to the ethics of Christianity. And that set her off. And so in June of 404, she ordered him into exile. Well, actually, her husband did, but we know who was pulling the strings. And from that point, he wrote letters to the church, well, like the New Testament authors did, but from that point on, he was pretty much out of the picture. So he was a controversial figure during his lifetime, during the period in which he was patriarch, but he was very well loved by probably a majority of the Christians in the Roman Empire, and it was only in the upper echelon circles of the Roman Empire that they loved display, they loved vanity and power, all these things that were contrary to Christian ethics. They were the ones that didn't like them.
So, in a word, they liked TV preachers.
Well, yeah, that could be. Yeah, so it's a testimony on the struggles. He is a his story is a testimony in the struggles that the church had at this time with what does it mean to be a Christian? You know, what are the ethics involved in being a Christian? Does it just mean I get baptized and I'm saved and then I can live just like a regular pagan? Or are other things involved? And this is a very interesting story, and you could see some things in his theology that you might disagree with as a Lutheran, but overall he is certainly a very a figure that is to be admired, and his writings can be read with a great deal of benefit.
One more question about Chrysostom, excuse me, and then this is to set up an email that we've just received from Eric that I'll bring up because it's a subject you've written about and commented on extensively. He is very liturgical. The St. John Chrysostom Mass, if anyone's ever heard that played on a classical radio station, we'll know it right away. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is a liturgical church. And,
yep.
And how influential is Chrysostom on what we have today as the liturgy?
Well, now, if I remember correctly, the Chrysostom Mass, isn't that the, is that the Russian or the Greek?
The Greek, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. The traditions of liturgy, in other words, what they say, what the canticles are and how they're ordered, are quite different between the East and the West. The West would be based on what was going on in Rome in about this time. You could even see divisions. This would be, again, the 5th century. And the East would be based on what was going on in Constantinople at the time. There were also other, we say, minor liturgical groups or traditions. There's one, I believe it's called the Mozaripic, which is based in Spain. There's the Gaul, which today is France. I forgot the Latin name for that. So there's several traditions of liturgy. Most of them drop out over a period of time, and what ends up being the dominant are the Western, from which we get the Latin rite of the Mass, and which is the basic structure and the basic parts of which we have in the Lutheran Church today. And then the East has something different, which tends to be much more lengthy, long litanies. My friend that used to be, I think he was Russian Orthodox. He said that the typical liturgy would go on for 2 or 3 hours with no sermon. So just the length is quite different. So I would say that the liturgy that's known as St. Chrysostom's liturgy, they claim that it goes back to that period. I'm not sure if it actually was authored by him, but it's definitely an Eastern rite, and it would be recognizable for people in those Orthodox churches.
It just shows the endurance of St. Chrysostom on the church.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, here's the question from Eric. He sent this in from his KFUO app. I'm somewhat new to the LCMS and have been hearing a lot about the sale of university chapels and synod politics on the Internet, and was wondering if you could explain the structure of the synod from the congregation up.
Oh, that's a good question. That could go on for a long time. Let's try to make that simple.
Well, just to give you a cue, we've got about 10 minutes before we have to hit the break.
Okay. hit the brakes? Is that what you said?
No. I wouldn't have asked the question if we were going to do that.
Okay, I'm kidding. The Missouri Synod is a it's a mixture. In some respects, it has aspects that are hierarchical. In other words, the synodical president, which is an executive power, the synodical convention, which is a legislative power, and then there's also synodical courts, which are called dispute resolutions, but that's basically their courts. Those they're top down, they're elected positions, and you know, if it pertains to what they're dealing with, you pretty much have to follow. And this mostly affects church workers. There, on the other side of it, though, the local congregation has its own structure, which would be usually almost all congregations have a voters' assembly, which is the final governmental authority. And that voters' assembly, which meets usually quarterly, they will elect the officers of the congregation. They will pass the annual budget, which determines how the resources of the congregation, how they're used. And then they also are the ones that make the ultimate decision on the calling of pastors and other full-time church workers. They may have other authorities, but that's usually a minimum. And then the many congregations operate with a board of directors or a church council that takes care of the week-by-week, month-by-month type of decisions. And these have mostly to do with financial and other business decisions. The pastors have a limited authority in their congregations. At least this has been the tradition of the Missouri Synod. The pastor is responsible, certainly, for doing what he does. So in terms of his preaching and Bible studies, his catechism, he is the one that calls the shots there. But if he teaches things contrary to what we've agreed upon, which is the Scriptures and Lutheran Confessions, he can be held to account. And if he refuses to change, he can be deposed by the voters' assembly. In other aspects, the pastor has very limited authority and mostly just influence, which we think is a good thing. And this is based on theological concerns of the Reformation and also some other decisions that were made when the Lutherans came to the United States and saw that they didn't have to do things exactly as it was done in Germany and Scandinavia, as long as within certain boundaries. And that would be primarily the maintaining of the pastor as a unique office that was instituted by Jesus, and also recognizing that congregations have the final say because they are together the priesthood of all believers. So that's a summary. The issues that the gentleman in the email brought up have to do more with things on the at the synodical level, and the synod is divided into districts. There are about 35 or 36 regional or geographical districts in the United States, and the districts have been given certain responsibilities, among which is the planting of new congregations, which we call that missions. It's a type of mission because there is a place where there has not been a Lutheran church before, and we're going to start a church there. So we gather funds from local congregations and gather that money together and help start new churches. We also try to support a number of other ministries, including campus ministries, and these are ongoing things. See, with a local congregation, the district helps fund that to get it started, and over a period of time, from maybe 5 to 10 years, when you get enough members, those members should be supporting the congregation. In the case of other ministries, like campus ministry or certain types of ethnic ministries, those type of ministries usually are not self-supporting. Campus ministry, because your congregation moves and changes all the time. You know, you just start getting the member going and understanding how to be to work as a Christian in a congregation, and as soon as they get a job, they leave because, you know, they move off campus. So the campus ministry has always been directly dependent on funding from the districts. In the ethnic ministries, we found that many cases, the places where those are located are where they're new immigrants into the United States, and we're reaching out to them, but as soon as they become conversant in American culture, they can speak English, and they can get a better job, they move out of that immigrant area. So these are areas where the districts have a long-term investment, and they need to keep funding those things. I guess some of the controversy that's coming now is because they're beginning to cut back some of those campus ministries, and they've been cutting back other things, and this is primarily due to the recession and the fact that contributions are down everywhere, and so what do they have left to cut? And the decision has to be made, and that's I think that's what this gentleman is talking about.
So when it, excuse me, Marty, when it comes to things like congregations, you mentioned pastors can be removed by the congregation if they go into heresy or if they're not, if they're negligent in their duties. But what about congregations? Can the LCMS remove an entire congregation? Is that even possible from the synod? And also explain what synod means. That may be important as well.
Yes. Well, first off, the word synod comes from, it's a Greek term, and it goes back to the early church where there were local meetings as opposed to an international worldwide council of all Christians. The synod would be a local thing. So if all the French pastors got together, or back then it was Gaul, it would be a synod in Orange, for example, which is a city in southern France. When the Lutherans moved to the United States, they were divided by first the colonies on the East Coast, and then when the United States became United States in 1780 or so, then they called their churches synods because they were organized according to the state. So one of your first churches was the Pennsylvania Ministerium, and that was all the pastors that were Lutheran in Pennsylvania. As they went west, they started moving into the states like Indiana or Ohio. And I think Ohio actually was the first of the churches that was called the Ohio Synod. And that was all the Lutheran pastors that were in the area of Ohio. And they would meet together every couple of years, and they were in fellowship with each other. And that's how the term came to be here in the United States. So it has been broadened in later years because we don't just meet in states, we meet nationally. And the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, as well as a couple other churches, still maintain that because we don't claim that we're the whole international Christian church. We're just a small part of it, and that's what the term synod means.
All right, with about a minute, can congregations be removed? Let's say someone, a pastor, decides he wants to be a crypto-Calvinist, and the congregation goes, cool by us, but we want to stay in the LCMS. What happens?
Well, that depends on the... it would have to go, charges have to be brought against him, and then it goes to the church court, and if he and the congregation refuse to budge and they don't want to be Lutheran in their teaching, then yes, both the pastor and that congregation could be removed. And there have been cases of that, but it's very rare, because usually the congregation, a majority of the people, they want to stay with it. But the biggest we've had in recent years was in the late 70s when many congregations voluntarily left the Missouri Synod because they disagreed with our teaching primarily on scriptures. And they formed the AELC and then later joined the ELCA in about 1989.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or like Eric, you can reach us by way of your iPhone app or just good old-fashioned email at KFUO at KFUO.org. Pastor Martin Noland from Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana, our guest for this Ask the Pastor portion. Any questions, any comments you've got, not necessarily on what we've discussed already, bring them up. The break is a great time to call in. We'll be right back after these few short announcements.
One of the core values of Concordia Seminary is faithfulness. Faithfulness to the Bible and the confessions of our church. Many people in America no longer believe that there is absolute truth. They say, you have your opinion, I have mine. All roads lead to heaven. But God has revealed truth. And we teach so that Concordia Seminary graduates will find winsome ways to present the truth.
Is it appropriate for a religious program like Law and Gospel to discuss the question as to who you will vote for as President of the United States? Appropriate or not, that is what we are going to do as one of the subjects during the next broadcast in our continuing series on Ruminations with our co-hosts, Pastors Mark Smith and Peter Kurowski. 1 o'clock, Monday through Friday.
On KFUO Radio.
KFUO Radio would like to help you when your church, school, or organization is having a special event. Contact us here at KFUO Radio and ask to be promoted with our date book announcements. Just give us the information about your event, the type of event, the date, the time, and the location, and we'll announce your event on the date book. These announcements are heard every hour throughout the day. KFUO Radio can help you make your event a big success. So get your message on the radio today. It's a public service of KFUO Radio.
How would you like to give a gift to KFUO Radio and a gift to your children at the same time? Wondering how that could be possible? Well, it's easy, and our trained staff of gift planning specialists can show you how. Many have benefited from this prudent method of estate planning, and we do all the work to set it up for you. Give us a call and find out how you can benefit KFUO Radio with your legacy gift.
Call Joan Harwell at 800-844-0524. That's 800-844-0524.
The Republican presidential candidates have discussed how faith would guide them as president. In Thursday's CNN debate, Congressman Ron Paul said when it comes to policymaking,
my religious beliefs wouldn't affect him. My religious beliefs affects my character and the way I treat people and the way I live.
Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich talked about the need for prayer in the White House.
Anyone who's president is faced with decisions so enormous that they should go to God.
Former Governor Mitt Romney agreed.
I would also seek the guidance of Providence in making critical decisions.
Former Senator Rick Santorum said,
I believe in faith and reason in approaching the problems of this country, but understand where those rights come from.
He and Romney noted that the Declaration of Independence declares that Americans' rights come from God, not from government. But Gingrich said,
there has been an increasingly aggressive war against religion, and in particular against Christianity in this country.
I'm Steve Coleman.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Whoever says you can't make a difference needs to know about the parents of middle schoolers in Clifton Park, New York. They got fed up with Planned Parenthood's sex education agenda and did something about it. Maureen Schiffler, a local mom, recruited a couple dozen parents through her church bulletin, and they went to the school board. One of the last draws was Planned Parenthood teaching their young children that oral sex is a form of abstinence. The Albany Times Union has now reported the school district nixed its 20-year relationship with Planned Parenthood. Parents, let this be an encouragement to you. Planned Parenthood is nothing but trouble when it comes to your children, and their own material is your best tool to use against them.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Good morning. Welcome back. This is Hour 2 of the Bible Study. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour. Our guest pastor this morning is Pastor Martin Nolan from Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. You probably remember him with great fondness as the resident historian of the Studio A program. And, we're still around. The weekend version of Studio A is going to run this weekend. A very important story, if I could just detract from Marty for one moment. I'm going to talk with Karen Malik this weekend. She has a website and an organization called the Coalition on Abortion and Breast Cancer. And in this 39th anniversary week, 39 years since Roe versus Wade, there are a lot of things you don't know that the medical community are not telling you about, other implications of abortion and hormone-based contraceptives, and what you don't know will kill you. be sure you listen Saturday starting at 1. That segment will air at 1:30. But check out the whole two-hour program. That's the weekend edition of Studio A. Marty, thank you for that short indulgence. Thank you, and welcome back.
Good to be here.
All right. Let's go right to the phones. We've got a bunch of questions that sort of want to stay on this riff that we've been on about synodical structure and how things work. Let's go to David first. David wants to know about how pastors get paid. David, good morning.
Well, I don't know. It might be a little bit off the subject, but I visited a Wells Lutheran church last weekend. And I was kind of curious. They're a lot smaller, I think, than LCMSs as far as people. And I think the pastor there had like a wife and four children. I'm just curious, how does, are they structured similar to the LCMS where who determines how much a pastor and a family of six gets paid? Is it the congregation or is it a synod or what? And one more little quick question, is the NIV a dangerous translation? And I'll listen on the radio.
All right, thank you, David. Okay, Marty, two questions. How do pastors get paid and should we use the NIV translation?
Okay, the first question, pastors get paid, first off, from the offerings that are collected every Sunday. Most congregations in the United States use an envelope system so that this encourages gifts because if you put money in an envelope, then you have a number and that goes into the financial secretary's account, and at the end of the year you get a statement indicates all the gifts that you made, and then you can take that as a charitable deduction in your taxes. If you just, you know, throw something in the plate, you're not going to get the benefit of that. So that's the revenue side. Congregations get money from other sources too, such as wills, bequests, from individuals. Sometimes people that have done pretty well for their in their careers, when they retire, they readjust their assets, and they'll I forgot what the exact term is, but it's a type of charitable gift in which a management is done by a foundation, and they the individuals will get a life income. It will take care of their needs until they head to heaven, and then also there's income that comes off of that that benefits not-for-profit agencies, including usually their congregation. There are other ways in which congregations get funding, but that's the primary way. Now, how does that go into the pastor or the support of the pastor? The decision on the pastor's salary and benefits is made by the congregation ultimately, and that's both in the case of the Missouri Synod and in the Wisconsin Synod. Usually the elders of a congregation are responsible for, you might say, managing certain aspects of the pastoral office, and that's one thing that they usually have responsibility for. So they will, in the call process, they'll be involved in establishing what the salary and benefits will be, and as years go on with that same pastor, they'll check, is this working out for you? How is your finances doing? And that, of course, is all confidential, and then they may need to make adjustments on occasion. In the Missouri Synod, I can't speak for the Wells, that's the Wisconsin Synod, the district offices usually supply the congregations with a, I forgot what it's called, it's called a salary scale. And this determines on the basis of the pastor's number of years in the ministry, primarily that, what is the appropriate, put it this way, the minimum amount that a pastor should be paid. The district scale is based on a number of different things. They look at what other ministers and other denominations are getting, what other not-for-profit or charitable organizations pay their employees. They also usually adjust it based on cost of living. So if you live in if a congregation lives in a very expensive part of the state, then they'll have to make adjustments otherwise, because the cost of living there for the pastor is much more. I know from my home congregation is in Cupertino, California, which is the home of Apple Computer in the middle of Silicon Valley, and they have some of the highest costs of living of anywhere in the continental United States besides Manhattan. And it's a big problem there. I mean, if you paid a pastor there what you would pay in, let's say, in upstate Missouri, he wouldn't be able to survive. This is why you see a difference in both on the basis of years of experience and also a cost of living, why there's differences in a pastor's salary. Now, the benefits, if they are in the Missouri Synod, that's Concordia Plans, which covers retirement and health and a few other benefits, those are pretty much the same across the board. There's like four or five different levels at which a congregation can give benefits to their pastors, and that's pretty much how that works. Congregations usually talk about stewardship once or twice a year to their members, and the tradition in the Christian church was a tithe, but that could be, you can argue, you know, what exactly is a tithe? Is it your net income or your original income? The Islamic people base it on your net assets. It's a percentage of your net assets that you're required to give. In the Lutheran Church, there's not a requirement. At least every congregation I've known, it's been voluntary. But they do recommend that you give proportionally to your income, and I think anywhere from 5 to 10% is a proper amount for regular members. And you know, of course, people get affected by the recession, so and other downturns, and you know, they, one year they may have a job, and then the next year they don't. So then you have to make adjustments in your giving, and everybody knows that. So that's generally the practices that is used today. And if a congregation, if most of the members that are active, if they're giving 5 to 10%, you could probably estimate that with 20 families that are giving at that rate, they'd be able to support a pastor. That wouldn't cover all the other expenses, but
right.
A 20-household congregation in which there's faithful giving, they can generally support a pastor at approximately a fair level.
And just real quick, David, second question, and we have some other calls we want to go to.
Go ahead.
The NIV translation, are there any problems with that? Is it a good translation to use if you want to do Bible study?
Every translation has problems, except for the Greek in New Testament and the Hebrew in the Old Testament. It's just because you have to make so many decisions. NIV was good when it came out. Now there are better translations. And so if you're thinking of purchasing one, I think the best translation generally for a wide variety of use is the ESV. I also like the New King James Version because I'm more familiar with some of the terms in the King James and the way that it flows. But NIV, I think, is now kind of an outdated thing, and there are a few theological problems with it, especially from the standpoint of Lutherans.
But it's not something, the problems are not so grave that it would give you a wrong understanding of what the Christian faith is.
I do not think so.
Okay. 505-7850 1-800-730-2727 and with great endurance, Herman has been waiting to get out. Thank you, Herman.
Yes, Dr. Nolan, does the case still prevail in the Missouri Synod on the congregation as the primary unit of identity of the church, and also in terms of the congregational ownership of its property is the first and last source of that ownership, to say, compared with some other denominations that claim that they own congregational property or congregational property is just being held in trust for the denomination by the local congregation?
Good questions, Herman. And I should have included that in my discussion of the how the church is structured. Members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, that is, lay people, are members of a congregation. They are not members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The pastors and church workers become members, and the congregation as a whole corporation is a member of the Synod. But the layman is not. And in many cases, laymen have very little either understanding of the Missouri Synod or even of the Lutheran Church in general. What they know about is their own congregation of which they're a member, and they know about the pastor. But they often take that for granted, and they don't realize that they get their pastor, and they get everything that's there from the ideas and structure and support of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So, yeah, it's that's why I said it's kind of mixed, because the identity of the lay member is with their congregation. Secondly, regarding ownership of property, and this was just reaffirmed by a revision to the Constitution of the Synod in about the last 10 or 15 years. It's very clear that all equity in the property of a congregation, that includes its financial assets that might be liquid or anything else, all of that belongs to the local congregation. So that's why you need a board of directors or something like that under state laws, so that it's properly managed when the government looks at it. So yes, and that's different from many other denominations. The LCA, which came into the ELCA, it was the tradition, I believe, that they, the church body, the National Synod, owned property, and the ALC was like the Missouri Synod. And when those two merged in 89, the convention encouraged congregations to turn their property over to the National Synod. Many refused to do that, and now those that did are often regretting that they did it. Because once you turn over the ownership of your property, it's out of your control, and then the National Synod can do with you as you please. So Missouri Synod has always been very careful about respecting the rights of the local congregation in regard to its property and its internal management. And I don't know of any church officers today that would disagree with that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Herman. Herman was waiting about 10 minutes to get through to you on that, Marty.
Thanks, Herman.
Yeah, so when I say endurance, that's a pretty good wait. You know, there's a couple of things in the news, but I may have cut you short. I think you wanted to finish a point before I went to Herman.
No, I think we covered everything in regard to pastors' salaries, which is what we were talking about before. It's just that you need to have about 20 households that give a proportional giving between 5 and 10% of their income. And if that's the case, you say, well, that's a small church. There's only about 40 or 50 people there. But if they are consistent givers, they can support a pastor. That's assuming that all their property is paid off in their building. And if they've got that cost, then they usually need more assistance.
Now, this story comes from the Christian Post. The Christian Post is a pretty decent website when it comes to seeing what's in the news. And the reporting generally doesn't come from any sort of a certain denominational angle. They kind of just lay it out there and report the news. Here's the headline: Pastors debate should denominations go away. The reason I pull this one up is because of what we've been discussing the last 40 minutes or so. It starts out by saying seven influential megachurch pastors took part in a live discussion, something called the Elephant Room. This took place just a couple of days ago in, of all places, Aurora, Illinois. I don't know how far that is from where you are, but probably not that great of a distance. And, you know, the whole idea was to sort of examine the church, but, you know, a lot more navel-gazing, I guess, is what this was about. And as the first line mentions, they're megachurches, and megachurches generally tend to be not affiliated. They may have a flavor of Pentecostal or the flavor of Baptist or whatever it may be, but they tend to be non-affiliated. So it seems kind of odd that pastors that don't have a denominational affiliation are discussing whether or not we should have denominations. But here's a couple of pull quotes that I want you to respond to. It says, no question denominations are diminishing in their impact, and frankly, a lot of them should go away, especially those whose theology and commitment to world missions is basically non-existent. And that was from a fellow named Jack Graham, who says he is loosely affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. He goes on to say, most people in today's culture aren't looking for a church affiliation or a denomination. Rather, they're looking for a Jesus church and a church that preaches truth and grace. Now, you read those couple of lines, what comes to your mind?
Well, I grew up in California in the Silicon Valley, and at the time, this would be the I was in, I entered high school in the early 70s. These mega churches just kind of got started at the time. There was a very famous one just north of us, known as Peninsula Bible Church. Ray Stedman was the pastor there, was well known in the southern part of the Bay Area. And this would be what you would call a mega church. It was non-denominational. He was basically Baptist, as far as I can tell. My brother was a member there for a couple years. So in high school, what I saw was a lot of high school students that had been raised in denominational churches, because there wasn't anything else for their parents to raise them in. They were starting to go to these places, and the mega churches really, some people might say were sheep stealing, but they really targeted young people from other churches. This was my experience in watching what was happening, talking to fellow Christians in my high school. Actually, I went to two high schools, so I had a broader base. They really weren't doing outreach to converting people that were not Christians. Now, I'm sure that they would always hold up the case of the person that was a convert, you know, the guy that had been through 12-step recovery program or something like that, a former druggie or whatever. That would be a testimony and say, you know, we're all like this. Yes, we're all like this. But no, they really weren't all like that. They were mostly people that had left Catholic churches, Lutheran, Anglican, Baptist, Methodist, all these other churches. Now, what would be the appeal? One of the things that they did at Stedman's church was they didn't really have any liturgy per se. They had a lot of music in the beginning, and then they went to the message, and that was it. So you didn't have all these prayers, what we call liturgy. So kids that had grown up in liturgical churches like Anglicans or Methodists or Lutherans, they thought, oh, we get to have a Christian rock band for an hour, and then we get a little message, and that's it. And so they were entertained, and they got a little bit of devotions, and that was it. So this was very, and I think this is why my brother and some of my friends that were Lutherans, that's why they went that way. They liked the entertainment. When I asked them about this after they left the Lutheran Church, I said, well, what about the theology here? And they said, well, we all teach the same thing. I said, well, you know, we know Catholics don't teach the same thing, right? Yeah, but I mean, well, and so they would dismiss the issue of theology. And I said, well, I don't even care about theology. Let's look at what are you teaching in the Bible. And they would also dismiss that. So the attraction was not for members of churches that really had a concern for what the Bible teaches. It was really more, in my experience, and this was in the early 70s, a social thing and entertainment. And it was big. It was kind of exciting that way. Now, Pastor Stedman is deceased now, and there are many other mega churches. They're tooting their own horn when they say this. And they want to be able to, by predicting, well, nobody can predict. Only the prophets of the Old Testament and the apostles had the power of prediction. Nobody knows what the future of the church is. So they can't say, oh, well, denominations are going away. Well, there is changing in the behavioral patterns of Americans in which churches they are going to. Actually, the fastest-growing churches are the Assemblies of God, which are a denomination that has a very strong confession of faith and a doctrine. We disagree with it. But they're actually, of all the Pentecostal type of churches, the Assembly of God is growing the most because they have a consistent doctrine across all their churches, and that's a denominational structure. So when you hear this from megachurch pastors, and they get a lot of attention, like, for example, Joel Osteen is he in Dallas or, no, he's in Houston.
Yeah.
He has the biggest church in Houston. So, you know, everybody goes to where the biggest thing is. You go to the biggest shopping mall, you go to the major league team that's in town. So because he's got the biggest one, he gets all the attention, he gets all the press. But if you add up all the churches in Houston, well, he's just a minor player, and And the other thing, from my experience in the 70s, was that we had some friends that went up to San Francisco and joined a mega church in San Francisco. And the pastor there was named Jim Jones. We never saw them again. So the downside of these, and that's when you say a denomination, what you mean is that congregations and pastors, they check each other. They make sure that they're holding the faith and they're not getting out of line. If you have an independent church, which most of these mega churches are, there's nobody to keep it in line. It's all centered around the personality of the pastor, and it can go Jim Jones' way. And when we saw that happen, then there was a lot among my friends that I grew up with, both in my church and my high school, there was a lot more skepticism about the wisdom of joining an independent church over where the pastor was, he called all the shots, and nobody, he was accountable to nobody.
We've got about 3 minutes left. Let's grab one more quick call from Joe. Joe, how you doing? Thanks for the call.
Good. I'm a member of a non-denominational church, not a mega church, but I agree with, you know, what you guys are saying, that I see that issue of accountability, it's always a struggle, and you're dependent on one person to stay true to the word. And the other thing I see is that the theology really does get diluted down, because there is no I guess creed that or councils that we can go and look at, or like in Lutheranism the catechism, and say, well, this is what our church believes. And that leads into a real lack of community based on Jesus Christ. And that's what we're always hearing, is how do we develop community in our church? And we try everything except doctrine to commune around. And it I don't know. I think it's probably, these guys are, I think they're wrong. Like, denominationalism has its issues probably, but non-denominational certainly does too, from my experience.
Marty, we've got about a minute and a half.
Thank you, Joe. I agree with what you're saying. And, you know, there's no perfect church, and I found among a lot of young people, they get attracted to these churches because they think they can find the perfect church. And, well, we're all sinners. It's part of our statement of faith, certainly as Lutherans. We're all sinners, but we're all saints through baptism. And so you just can't find the perfect church. And as all my friends were leaving the Lutheran church when I was in high school, I went back to the scriptures and said, well, what does the Bible really say? And which churches teach closest to what the scriptures say? And that's why I stayed with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And so I encourage everybody that may be listening today, or if you have friends that are thinking about changing churches, say, what does the Bible say, and how close does this church teach that and practice it, and make the decision on that? Because then you're as close as you can get to what Jesus really wants us to do, because it's clear that he wants us to keep his word.
Now, I don't want to seem overly sensitive, but as I've read some other sources about this same meeting, this elephant room thing, you do get the distinct impression that to be in a denomination is to worship the denomination. That's why they've used this term, looking for a Jesus church.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's interesting. I had never heard that one before. Well, you know, there may be, I'm not sure there's anybody that would say they worship the denomination. Most people think that's a necessary evil.
Well,
to put it that way.
But, you know, in a lot of ways, Marty, I think it's, you know, brand X versus brand Y. You got to tear down brand Y to make your brand X look better.
Yeah. But the thing is, it supplies necessary things, and part of that, at least for Lutherans, is accountability. And if you don't have accountability, then things can really go bad.
Absolutely. Pastor Marty Nolan serves at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Man, it's fun to spend time with you. Thanks for coming back on the program.
Thanks, Roland. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks. Have a great weekend. All the best, my friend.
Okay.
All right, guys, you have a great weekend. We're back on Monday. We're still in Hebrews chapter 4. More Ask the Pastor following that. And then don't forget Studio A, 1 o'clock Central Time tomorrow. We'll be talking about abortion and health risks. What you don't know will kill you. Be sure you tune in.
Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.